Session number 7363.
Mr. Jameson, tape three. Could I ask you a little more about signals? You mentioned a couple of other systems.
Yes, well, the times that I remember using, I never remembered using a heliote any time.
What were they?
Well, it was purely a mirror, and it depended upon the sun. And you lined it up in the direction that you are going to signal, and by flicking it like that, you could Morse code flashes from the sun to some distance away, you see, by just flicking a thing like that. That's still possible. I mean, if you get the sun coming in a certain direction, you get a mirror onto it, and somebody's a half a mile away over there, you could flick a Morse signal to them quite easily. But what we did use, and what was a very, very common use in the army, was the Lucas lamp. And the value of that was that you could go off to an OP, and you could line this. You knew your map spotting of the OP, and you knew your map spotting of the battery, so that you could get a magnetic bearing on it from where you were, and you would just sight your Lucas lamp in their direction. And this thing had a tube on it, so that only actually at that particular point in distance would that light show. And you could tap out a Morse key there by just flicking a shutter in this lamp, you see, and you could signal messages direct to the battery with a Lucas lamp that nobody else could see.
What was it lit by, the Lucas lamp?
An oil lamp, a little oil wick, and just a flicking shutter. And it would work in the daytime too, being like that. And if you get the tube, you get any light through a tube like that and sight it on another place, you can flick a light through that, and only that one can see, and anybody just a half a degree either side, they won't see any light from it. We used the in a comic cut stunt that we got written up in the divisional comic cuts at Newport. We used the Lucas lamp quite a lot, very usefully.
Could you describe what happened there?
Well, at Newport. It'll come in later, won't it? Or not? Briefly, what happened was that the Newport, of course, was a place where 2 feet below the ground was water. The place was intersected with dikes about every 60 or 80 yards, and a shell going into the ground half a mile away, you'd hear the bonk under your feet with a water hammer, you see. The result was we couldn't dig, so we had to build a bund along and put the guns behind that. Not much use really, except not even very much protection, as it turned out. But what happened there was that we were right up at the coast, right on the, we went right to the seashore at that end and came down, I can't remember the name of the river, but anyhow, the river that intersected us from the Bosch on the other side, Newport town was here. And where we were on the other side, of course, was Ostend and the way up the coast, and back this way is La Panne and Complage and these places. And we had one bit they called the Redan, which we were bulged out on the other side of the river. And to get at it, the bridges had been all shot away, and we had floating duckboards. And they used to run across these things, and the Jerrys used to shoot these up from enfilade and blow them to pieces, and we'd get them ripped up again and run across again. But one thing that happened there was that in Newport itself, of course, the buildings were all pretty well decimated. The Belgians had built up one by three stories. They'd concreted up the corner of this building all the way up three stories, and they'd got ladders up on the back of this, and right at the top were just a few planks driven into this corner of brickwork, very strongly reinforced with concrete in the back of it. But look from the other side, I'll show you a picture of it in there. just a little sort of hole in the wall, which had been a window, and used to climb up this ladder up there and sit on these planks up there and look through at the enemy. And there were no, the German aircraft used to come along the front line every evening and photograph, see what was going on, see what different, what strengthening extras had been going on, so forth, generally sort of recording progress. And there was only one anti-aircraft gun that would come up on a lorry up the main road between us and the sea, run up to this copse and fire off a few rounds at this thing and then beat it. And our infantry were fed to the teeth about this constant surveillance, nobody doing anything about it. So we'd been up, Drew and I had been up in the front line taking notes of targets they wanted to have shot up for them, and in conversation with them, they were fed to the teeth about this, these Jerry planes that could just fly unmolested. And couldn't somebody do something about it? So after we were walking back, Drew said, you know, Jimmy, I think we could do something about that. I think I've got an idea. He said, you know what a hay bogey is? I said, oh, yes, I do. He said, well, we see if we can find one in some of these farmhouses away back behind us. So we went for a walk away back behind the battery position. Went for about half a mile back, and we got to some farm buildings, and we found a hay bogey. And he said, right, that's what we want. In the meantime, while we were getting on with all this, the Germans had been paying us a little bit of attention on the battery position. Our number one, our A battery, was away. We were three batteries in line, and A battery had been one bright afternoon started off with a 5.9 battery shoot on it and just absolutely plastered the position. Ammunition going up in smoke, fires going, and predictably, this was what I was coming to before, predictably you could tell how many rounds you would fire and what pause there would be. And in between these pauses, we would rush into this battery position, haul out anything inflammable and chuck it anywhere so that it didn't form such a terrific fire that he would say, oh, this is something good, and really shoot it up severely. But it didn't seem to matter very much because the place got shot up anyhow. I think we wasted our efforts. But A battery then came to live with us for a while until they got themselves sorted out. And then the next afternoon they started on B battery. Well, now while that was going on, we had got this hay bogey up to the battery position. And Drew said, when he'd done, on one afternoon he'd wiped up A battery, and next afternoon they'd wiped up B battery. He said, well, we're not waiting for them to do us in. Tonight, while that's coming over to photograph that tomorrow, he said, tonight we're going to have our guns out of here. So all our six guns were pulled out of there and taken back about 200 yards and put up under camouflage netting, just on poles. And the next afternoon, sure enough, he started off with a 5.9 shoot on us and fairly decimated the position. Tin arcs and sandbags and gun pits were all busted, you see. And as soon as he'd finished, we shoved one gun straight back into one of these shot-up gun pits. So, of course, sure enough, the plane came over and photographed the damage and photographed the thing all nicely shot up and went away satisfied, you see. But we'd got one gun in there. Now, as soon as we'd watched all this happen, we pulled the gun out, pushed the hay bogey in, and sandbagged it all so that we had a platform ramp like that, you see. And then we got that nicely sandbagged up so it was pretty solid. Then we ran the gun up there and roped that in and sandbagged it. That gave us about a 30 degree elevation more than we would get on the normal elevation on the gun. Now he said, Jimmy, the next idea is to try and see if we can do any damage with this. So he said, you take yourself up to the OP, which was away to the right flank of Newport, and be sure to take some wood with you to make a little rough director, just a flat bit of wood with a stick with a nail through it, you see. and stick that on the peephole there. And when this plane comes along, as he did every evening, just sight him and draw your lines on, you see, in about three positions, at about, perhaps about 30 or 40 degrees difference, you see. We won't have many chances for many of them. So I did this, and then I brought it back with me in the evening to the position, you see, with these marks on it, and we studied it with the map and where the position was, and on our shooting map, we drew the lines where these came on to show where we were likely to have the best opportunity of doing a bit of damage. And then he said, "Now tomorrow, before this fellow arrives, sometime during the day, we're going to fire a few air bursts, just to check on this." So I went off again up to the OP, and the next morning, the next day, and right, we're going to fire number one. So number one fired, and there was an air burst up. And I corrected that for this thing, you see, and said, "Right, make a note of that one." Then we tied the next one. Then, having got about three positions like that with air bursts on the right lines, then all we had to do was to drop the elevation, say 10 degrees or more, and we'd get down to where we would want them to really try and do some damage. And now he said, "I think we're about ready for this fella now. So the next time it's nice and fine and the bloke comes over to photograph, off he will go to the OP and we'll see what we can do for him." And he said, "All we've got to do now is he'll as soon as he passes the mark which you've got on there, 5 degrees in from that will be the line we'll shoot on for the next one. So as soon as he passes that one, we'll have taken the time signal for that amount of traverse, and all you've got to do on your D3 is to just press the button like that, and we'll biff off 5 rounds rapid, you see, like this. And then you can switch to the next one, and the same procedure, press the button again, and off we go again." Well, we fired, I think we managed to get about 5 rounds rapid off at each of these different places. The first time didn't seem to have much effect on him. The second time he sort of veered off the line of his photographing completely. And on the third occasion, I think we must have got closer to him than ever, because he just turned and ran home. But the next day, there was a plane came searching around over our position, and the place was very well and truly shot up. However, we were tickled pink at our success at this, you see, and when we went up to the front line again and talked to the infantry, they were pleased as punch that we'd scared him. And stock went up like nobody's business. And of course it was all written up in comic cut and went all round the division. Everybody roared with laughter.
Was that a sort of magazine you had, Comic Cuts, that you
produced? Well, we called it Comic Cuts. What actually used to happen was the division would circulate, and we would attach to this division at that time, because by that time we were army brigades. But yes, division used to circulate a thing we called Comic Cuts, which was just a couple of sheets of Roniod stuff about what was going on, what moves were being made, and so forth. And then any sort of incident that might interest anybody was put in at the foot, you see. And that was what we got our stock out like nobody's business.
That must have been very good for morale, I would
think.
Oh
yes, oh yes. Things like that were great fun. On the other hand, you see, now just not so very long after that, it had been rather damp, and Jerry had, I'd been up in the front line for a 24-hour spell up there, and I came back, and I thought, I'm going to have a nice night's sleep. And we were sleeping on duck boards, on just little tin arcs about that high, you see, we couldn't dig. So I crawled into my flea bag and got into this thing for a night, having taken off everything but put on a pair of pajama trousers. And there was a full echelon of ammunition came on the position, and Jerry started to shell the battery position with pipsqueaks and gas mix, you see. And the yell went up, get the damn horses off the position at any cost. Well, of course, they leapt out of this hole, pulled on a pair of gumboots and a tin hat and just a pair of pyjama trousers and was pulling shells out of the limber like this here and just letting them fall on the ground everywhere and shooing the teams off straight away. As a result of that, I got badly burned with gas, as a matter of fact, because rushing about in a hot, sticky sort of night, damp, you know, the mustard gas attacked damp parts on you, and I was skinned badly and had to be plastered up. But we only lost one horse, and that's all. And
you managed to get them back away from the gas, did you?
We managed to get the wagons and the teams off the position. People just simply descended on one and pulled all the things out. Off you go, and then the next lot, you see, and got them off quickly. There was only one horse hit, and we had to get the quick releases off that and shoo that out with four horses and the one being led. And this is how your stock goes down. When this was all over, the next day, when the ration party came up again, the NCO who had been in charge of the ammunition train that had come up the night before was told, get a party up there with a wagon, spare wagon, and load that horse onto it and take it away several miles back and have it properly buried. Well, of course, he didn't live in our area. He wasn't probably conscious of the fact that this NCO took the horse away about over nearly 2 miles, it might have been, and thought, oh, these ditches are handy. So he dumped it in a ditch and covered stuff over it and thought, well, that's it. Wouldn't bother to cart it all the way back 5 miles back to the wagon line and find a place and cart it there and bury it properly. There's a nice homemade ditch ready for it. Well, in about a week, the place absolutely stank to high heaven. A decomposing horse in a dike that distance away, the water carrying it all round like this network of dikes, you see. Whew. People said, where the devil's all, where's all that coming from? Who's responsible for this? And Drew said, I wonder whether so-and-so, where he put that horse. So I sent for him. And he had to admit then that where he put it. Right, he said, you can take the party you had on that lark, you can go back and you can dig it up and you can put it into a GS wagon and cover it with chloride of lime or whatever and take it right away. And he said, when you've got it out of there, you properly disinfect the whole of that area as well. But our stock went down a bit after that because we got blamed for it.
That must have happened quite a lot, didn't it, with sort of bodies, men falling into dikes.
Oh, yes. In particular, the Somme, you couldn't do anything about it. You had to stand it. Where you got a combination of mud and terrific firepower and constant attacks taking place, there were an awful lot of people killed and that couldn't be retrieved. And I think probably still are. Some parts of the Somme battlefield would be so shot up that nothing you could do about it. In some ways, you've been over there, I expect. You've seen some of it, have you? No. There are places, there are parts of it where they've not been able to do anything with the ground, so although it's grassed over now, it's just a lot of hummocks like this, you see, which at the time that it happened would be pocketed with shell holes and mud to such a concentrated extent that you couldn't really put a hand down where there was a spare space. That, for instance, took place at the attack, the Canadian attack on Vimy. The firepower concentration at Vimy was terrific, and the weather was so bad that the attack was put off for 24 hours. It didn't make much difference, as a matter of fact, because the fire preparation, the concentration, was so terrific that there wasn't a half inch of ground anywhere that hadn't a shell hole in it. Mind one thing, that, again, talking about these night things, I don't think anything has ever struck me as so impressive as the silence just before an attack starts. 0 hour, maybe perhaps say 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and it's dark, and the, generally speaking, the front line is quiet. There's an odd bump, maybe an odd shell goes over, but generally speaking, comparatively speaking, it's fairly quiet. You get the odd shell every now and then. Perhaps Germans may think they'll shell a certain crossroads in case there's some ration parties coming up, and they'll get a few salvos fired onto that and it'll die out. Then you may hear a few machine guns going on the front line, different places where perhaps listening parties have gone out. And generally speaking, it's quiet. And then suddenly, you know the zero time, of course. Suddenly, from the air suddenly fills with a whoosh, like that, terrific surging sound like that, and all along the front, as far as you can see, is pinpoints of light doing this, see? And those are shells. And gradually, of course, as it becomes daylight, the effect of these bursts, of course, is that you've got a fog that's just drifting as well. But to see the opening of a barrage, the opening barrage of an attack that's going to be really something, to see that gunfire in the dark suddenly light up, and you know 0 hour's gone, the whistle's blown, and the whole horizon as far as you can see is a flicking lot of lights, and this surging wind going over the top of you with the heavier ones as well above them. It's most impressive, awe-inspiring really. And you wonder, there again, they give the Germans full marks for their amazing efficiency. You wonder how they ever survive. That they had such wonderful dugouts that they used to disappear into these things, and then when they knew, of course, there would be an opening barrage on the front line, and then after a certain length of time it would lift 150-200 yards and fire on the support trenches, and the infantry would be then supposed to go forward and take the front line. But they would then pop out of these holes, and their machine guns would come out, and they were deadly. Really were. A combination of a horizon which is black to start with and quiet, and full of pinpoint lights, and with it this terrific noise of shh over the overhead, with the heavier ones like trains going over the top of them, and then the rumble, and it's just a complete thunder that you can hardly hear yourself speak.
Do you get a lot of smell as well with all that?
No, of course it would depend. At one time you used to get smell because the Germans used gas, but apart from that, no.
Could I now go back to the defence of Ypres at the mm-hmm. end of 1914? Mm-hmm. You did indicate that the division was badly decimated.
Very. Mm-hmm. That happened to most divisions that went in there. The fighting took place over such a concentrated area. The cloth hall was destroyed. Ypres was reduced to ruins. Various places were well known by names like Hellfire Corner and places like that, you know. our job, of course, at that, as I say, our job at that time had been a sort of, we were partly in reserve in case we were needed, in which case, as I say, some of our squadrons were in action there, and others of us were, when they talk about carrying messages.
Were you in action at all there?
No, I was in the, I was first of all on the cavalry screen, and then later as a message carrier. I went back, as a matter of fact, from the front line back to way beyond Ypres to collect a battalion that was supposed to come lying there in reserve. And when I got there, I found that got already had a message from some in some other way and gone. Now the conditions. That may sound quite simple, but the conditions were terrible. The weather was terrible, and the roads in France at that time was a centre of pavé, with a wide stretch either side, which was ordinary earth, but in the wet was mud, so that you had to keep on the pavé if you're going to survive. And I was sent off from this place. I went back from this little cubbyhole where we were, and the signals were concentrated, picked up my horse and rode off down the road to the accompaniment of odd shells bumping around, you know, various times. The message job wasn't quite as easy as it seemed. I got so far, my horse went lame. So I stuck him in a field and walked on a bit, saw some bicycles lying in a bit off the road, so I pinched one, got on it and rode off with that. After a while, it's sliding a bit off in the pavé and whatnot and picking up mud. These old army bicycles, you know, were heavy. It was jammed up with mud everywhere, so I got sick of that, and I just chucked that off onto the side of the road and walked on. Walked through the square of Ypres and went on to this place, and then found that these people had already been advised and had come back. I come back again, raining, wearing a greatcoat, mud up to the eyebrows, pick up this bicycle and push that back. It won't ride anymore. Push that back to where I'd found it, dump it in, collect my horse, walk on with that because it's still dead lame, park it where they were left in this tumble-down building bit, and go on into the signal place and report the result of my efforts, and then look round for somewhere to find to sleep. And I looked around. There were just, it's like an odd yard somewhere with odd buildings and things. I couldn't find anywhere. Raining, dead tired,